Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to Tragedy and Hope with my excellent co-host, Richard Grove. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Maria. Good morning, Maria's subscribers. How are you guys doing?
I'm sure they're excited. I know people have been missing you on the show, so I'm glad you're back. And for people that are new to the show, please get over to tragedyandhope.com and check out Rich's work because he's truly one of a kind. Rich, we look at this world, you and I had a little chit-chat yesterday, we look at this world and a lot of people, what I notice is a lot of people are posting how sad, how depressed, how angry they are since this election. It's like they just can't shake it. They're literally like suicidal. So, you know, I made a quick little meme this morning and just said, don't be depressed, 65% of us. Don't agree with Trump. You know, the truth of the matter is the media makes it look like his fans are the majority.
Well, the first message I would have to people would be stop watching the news. Stop watching the news and start thinking optimistically insofar as you have access to the internet. It is the greatest potential for self-knowledge and learning and autodidactic activities that has ever been created. But most people are being consumers of the internet and not using it to be some sort of producer in the world. And I mean by learning new skills that make your life better, that help you be calm, be confident, be competent, and to live a good life. And if you're not focused on that and you're focused on latest drama with whoever on whatever news channel and latest mass casualty event that we really can't learn anything about from the news, you're going to start feeling less than optimistic, and the world is going to become a much smaller place than it needs to be or actually is, because the optimism comes from learning that you can learn every day and you're still not going to know very much compared to all this knowledge that's out there. So there's always things yet to be learned, and all these problems that we see are waiting to be solved, but they're not going to be solved from an emotional standpoint where we feel like we don't have any control in the situation.
Absolutely. Well, like I tell my audience, I watch the news so they don't have to. But I only watch the news to see what lies they're spewing and how they'll spend an entire day on one story as if nothing else is happening in the world. And people don't realize it's like being spoon-fed pablum to a baby, you know. And I see everybody getting all wild and crazy with each other. You know, for me, I'm usually laughing out loud or arguing against them like men watching football. Because I do the research, you know, and you obviously do the research, but you do the research for hundreds of years. There's the difference. Hundreds of years.
I think what you're describing is your role as a professional news analyst with your news show every Monday, right? Have to look at these things. It's your job and responsibility to take all that stuff in and help your audience understand it. But from the audience end, trying to learn by watching the news is a lot like exercising or trying to exercise by watching an infomercial on exercising, right? So as a historian, I try to avoid the current events and all that stuff that's going on. And when I do want to learn something, I prioritize it because there's a lot of things to learn and I can't learn everything today. So what in my priorities and my goals do I need to learn today? Where can I follow my interest to this unknown and get some knowledge about it? So I don't look at the current events most, but I'm also optimistic. So that like there might be a correlation. There might be some causality there too, because I think the mainstream media is there to drive public emotion and to do, especially right now, divide and conquer among people who have so much in common with each other. And yet if that's not talked about on those mainstream channels, you forget about it. And people are getting so easily, emotionally triggered. And that's not helping to resolve these problems or recognize those problems exist or learn from why those problems exist and solve the problem.
Right. Well, they don't realize that they're getting played. You know, when I look at the news, and of course, you know, I dissect the news from many different viewpoints and of course from my own spiritual vision of the bullshit that's out there. It makes it easier for me to find a segue to talk to just about anybody. And if I can talk to people in a total Republican state and get them to listen and actually have discourse as two, you know, normal, calm human beings, I continue to do that because we do have more in common than we have differences.
So if that's the objective reality, then why are people getting played? If I had to answer that question, I did have to answer that question for myself at one point. I was like, why am I getting played? It's because there are machinations and institutions in place when you were born here that you weren't taught about in school, that aren't talked about on the news, that have effects on your everyday life. And until you learn the history and the evolution and the historical lineage of the ideas encompassed in that institution, you're going to miss it. So talking about everybody being played, I would recommend a book because this is a good starting point for learning. Books aren't the end point. They're a good starting point. The book is called The Mighty Wurlitzer. And once upon a time, they used to have these organs that they would play for audiences called a Wurlitzer. And the CIA turned America into its Wurlitzer. So they could play the American population to use emotions, to use divide and conquer, to use a whole bunch of psychological black ops strategies on the population. So you can read this book, The Mighty Wurlitzer, and it's by Hugh Wilford, who also wrote an excellent book on the Great Game and America's role in the Great Game, which ties back into the CIA. And then once you know that the mass media that you see at Barnes & Noble or at your local place where they're selling newspapers and all this media that you're surrounded by on TV and video and smart devices, that's all there not with the purpose of helping you learn or inform yourself so you can make good decisions in your life and find happiness. It's more of a manipulative concealment of information and a selective proposal of information that gives you an inaccurate map of what's going on, and thereby people take emotional steps and the people who are on the other end of that causality benefit. So that's a 1 minute description of the mass media environment in America. And if you don't know about it, you're going to be played by it. So I see this as a great opportunity to teach people about that which exists and all this fascinating history behind it, because so many people find that to be a pain point these days in their lives.
Exactly. They just sit back and don't understand, you know, why this is happening. They don't even want to look at who's pulling the strings on what is happening. So they just don't realize they're getting puppeted through their life from pretty much the minute we're born. You know, I was telling somebody who was very young about John Lennon's song, Working Man's Hero. And I suggested that person listen to it, because John Lennon wrote that song in the 60s. But every word in that story is true of how we're puppeted and indoctrinated from the minute we're born.
Well, first off, one of my favorite John Lennon songs. So let me add something to that. John Lennon also co-authored a David Bowie song called Fame. Listen to those two songs back to back and take those two messages, and you're getting bookends on our entire society.
Absolutely. And that's why I tell people to, you know, I mean, it's a valiant effort. It's certainly not 100% of, you know, the truth of what happened. But I do recommend
the entire
people
audience
watch.
Just went to YouTube, Maria. No one's listening.
the entire audience is gone. But I tell people to watch the movie. You can watch it on Netflix. It's probably on YouTube. The U.S. versus John Lennon. To really understand how this country works against anyone that speaks truth or against power, and especially against war, because I've seen so many heroes, you know, anti-war people, peacenicks, that have, you know, it's cost them their lives. And, you know, a lot of what he wrote about, you know, even though he got a lot of crap from the media, which, of course, was already, you know, mostly owned by the CIA by the 70s, he still did what he came here to do, and he risked his life for it, and it cost him his life. He's, you know, one of many.
Well, one of the interesting pieces of history on the assassination of John Lennon is, you know, most people are like, oh, Mark David Chapman shot John. No, well, first off, look at the people who were at the scene when he got shot. The doorman of the Dakota Hotel was a guy named Jose Perdomo, if memory serves, who was part of the CIA's like Operation 40, Operation Mongoose, assassination and kill teams in the early 60s. So I find it very interesting that a guy like that with that history is working as the doorman there when John Lennon got shot. That's just one little piece of That's just something to get you looking and reading. Go get some books on it now. Figure it out.
Well, exactly.
History's a mystery until you unravel it.
Right. And, you know, many people have uncovered the assassination on John Lennon, the same as they did on Princess Diana. And yet there are people that still believe the official story, but then they believe the official story on everything.
First off, believing the official story is always at least boring and usually misleading. So even if you believe the official story on anything, I urge you to look deeper into that incident. Like for Princess Diana, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I am interested in history. And there's a lot of interesting history when you get into who is the Fayed family, who was Dodi Fayed, who is his father, what is Herod's, like, you know, what relationships these people all have together prior to that. Learn the history, learn the context and the historical lineage of what's going on with people's kids. You know, not Diana, but she comes from the Spencer family, which is a famous British family to start with. And Dodi Fayed was the heir to a huge fortune. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of interesting things just in that. So you don't have to be conspiratorial and be like, she was assassinated. But if you look enough into the evidence, you're probably going to say the official story is not an accurate representation of what happened. And then why do you have to go any further? Because you've just now filled in the blank for yourself. You know more about it. You know more about the world. Move on and learn some more stuff. Don't get hung up on it necessarily and like spend your life trying to figure that out. Although some people do that and sometimes their research is useful and interesting. So I'm not telling anybody what to do.
Right.
Just observing.
Well, yeah, there are people that, you know, they actually even believed that we were going to get a total release of the JFK papers because they've been covering JFK since it happened. But, you know, my sensibility and brain said, yeah, there's no way we're getting all those papers. And if we do, it's going to be redacted. And it's exactly what happened.
Can I offer a plausible and interesting piece of research, if you want to go into it, reason why?
Of course.
We happen to be, not we, the United States government and its intelligence apparatus has a relationship with Britain. See, if you start talking about America, like that's us, like no, these people that run the government, they have a relationship with the British intelligence agencies, right? The Anglo intelligence agencies. So that's Britain and America working together. So America has policies on its top secret documents and when they, you know, how long they can be held before they're released to the public. The British have different rules. And their rules, if you apply them to the JFK situation, it would say anything where they're involved would still be held top secret and not available in the public. Now, that's an interesting hypothesis. Is there any evidence to that? Well, I conducted an interview with a former attorney from the Department of Justice who had access to the Anglo-American and NATO records from that time period. And that is part of the security apparatus. So if there is British involvement in the JFK assassination, if there intelligence groups were involved with the CIA or the mob or whoever else was involved, that would still be held secret. And so that's an interesting little avenue to look into because a lot of people don't consider that as part of their JFK research. But in terms of American and British relations at that time, the Dulles brothers were fully working for the British Empire their entire career in State Department and intelligence. So John Foster Dulles was the Secretary of State. His brother Allen Dulles was in charge of the CIA. JFK fired Allen Dulles, and then Allen Dulles ended up being in charge of the commission to investigate the death, right? So there's no conflict of interest there. So in looking at who got fired, like who Kennedy kicked somebody out, that guy represented the British interests, and then that guy was then in charge of the entire investigation. And the first person that said, we want Oswald, was Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach, who is a Rhodes Scholar, which Rhodes Scholars are an Anglo-American creation to take American students and students from all sorts of countries and Anglify them through the rites of Oxford. So there's a couple different angles there that nobody really looks into. And there's a lot of interesting history behind that. So that might be a plausible reason why some of the records are being withheld.
Mm-hmm. Well, pretty interesting stuff for sure. And let's not forget, Bill Clinton was a Rhodes Scholar.
Absolutely. There's both of the recent Librarians of Congress Daniel Boorstin and James H. Billington are Rhodes. One of them also Skull and Bones. This is a pinnacle of power controlling the Library of Congress, for instance. I'm not saying there's anything nefarious about it. I'm just saying it's interesting when you start to ask these questions and follow these lines of thought.
Well, what was Cecil Rhodes' intention of putting together this, his plan or his Rhodes scholars out there in the world?
All right. Well, Cecil Rhodes, was schooled at Oxford. He was funded by the Rothschild family. He created the De Beers Diamond Cartel, and he was a Freemason. So what he did, which was like deviously brilliant in a Machiavellian way, is he took people's pre-existing goals, not people's, but groups. So the Freemasons had a goal, the Rothschilds had a goal, the British Empire had a goal, and he's like, hey, if I roll those all into one, I could probably do pretty well. And he did. And in his last will and testament, he left his money to create the Rhodes Scholarships, and he wanted to create a secret society. This is in his last will and testament, that he wanted to create a secret society for the purposes of a bunch of things, which included bringing America back into the British Empire. He died in 1902, and then a whole bunch of groups that were loyal to the British Empire that still existed in America got together. They created the Pilgrim Society, the Federal Reserve, the Council on Foreign Relations, and much of what you see today as America's governmental infrastructure, as far as most people who are in State Department or in the executive or judicial branch, and the legislative branch, come from these Anglophile groups like the Council on Foreign Relations, for instance, Trilateral Commission, Bilderberg Group. These groups all have something in common, and they're different working groups with different agendas, but they have common goals. And this is a completely left out of our public education, our college education, and any education you might hope to get through mass media. Like this is all going on. This is an agenda 115 years in motion at this point, with a lot of momentum, and it's still not on anybody's radar. So, there's a lot to that. But all this statues being pulled down and stuff in America, that started in South Africa or in Zimbabwe, both, with groups wanting Cecil Rhodes's statue to be taken down. Because, you know, like in America, we would say, if somebody's really bad, they're like Hitler. But that doesn't apply in Africa. Rhodes was the Adolf Hitler of Africa. You know, he created concentration camps back in the 1800s. He created the policy of apartheid, right? And some of these policies still continue today. Like, apartheid is real in some of the countries that America calls allies. There's a lot of historical connections to all of that. That's what I'm saying.
Right. Well, I mean, Israel is still the same. It's also an apartheid state. You know, they couldn't understand why after 100 years people were still protesting in the streets against the Balfour Declaration, which was commemorated last month. And that's another part of history most Americans don't know. They have no knowledge whatsoever of the Rothschilds' involvement with the Balfour Declaration and how Israel came to rip away Palestine from the Palestinians.
Well, that's a great lead-in to a shameless promotion of my ongoing book project, Maria.
Okay, go ahead. Shamelessly promote.
For my book, The Truth About the Rothschilds, two of the more interesting areas that I can call to memory are the declaration known as the Balfour Declaration on November 2nd, 1917. So this year is the centennial of that. And there's a great website called Balfour100.com or .org. It's one of those two. And you can see the five versions, the five, you know, pieces of evolution, you know, the first document and the end document of what became the Balfour Declaration. So the Balfour Declaration, the end document, is addressed from the British government to Lord Rothschild, who is accepting it on behalf of the Zionists of Britain. And it's giving the land of Palestine, which the British held, to the Zionists. So it's a famous historical document that still has a lot of relevance today, because there's still not peace in the Middle East, and you have to learn the history of what happened to understand why there's not peace in the Middle East. So that's a famous historical document. It's the 100th anniversary. And if you follow it back to what was the first version of that document, it's a letter from Lord Rothschild to his working group. And all the people that were in the working group of the iterations are part of the Cecil Rhodes working group. So it starts with a letter from Lord Rothschild to his working group, and then the working group sends him back on behalf of the British government, "Dear Lord Rothschild, here's Palestine." So it's an amazing part of history. I would bet that no one listening was taught anything about this really during high school or college. And if you were, you probably only got a part of the story. And it was a long time in building up to that point. It just didn't come out of nowhere. The earliest reports that I've seen, in the book that I've recorded and referenced and found the source materials and everything, it's a 1829 and 1833 and 1835 newspapers. So three separate articles that were talking about the Rothschilds and their interest in Palestine at that point. And then toward the 1860s and 1870s, they actively start to colonize it and buy up land and teach people how to farm. And so there's a whole, like, I have several books just on that topic of their development. So I think that, so the only argument I make in my book is that the Rothschild family, starting with Meyer Amschel Rothschild and his five sons who set up banks in various countries back in the 1700s and 1800s, have had a substantial effect on Western history, and we're not taught about it. So I think people should know about it because it helps you really understand all these seemingly disparate points in our history have a lot of similar and causal financial connections to them. So that's why I was really fascinated by the project.
Well, they also, you know, right. Well, it's a great project, and if people want to help out, of course, I'm going to put a link here today where you can help, you know, contribute to the fundraiser for the book and the documentary, because this is something everybody needs to know, because the Rothschilds truly are at the top of the food chain here. And a lot of people don't realize they were even involved in the Civil War, you know, trying to get Lincoln to borrow money from them to continue the war. And that was when Lincoln, I guess, pulled the final bullet on himself when he decided to make his own money.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting history. So what I found most interesting is right before the Civil War, the Rothschilds send one of their next generation, Solomon de Rothschild, who I think was like 28 years old. They send him to America, and he comes here from like 1859 to 1861. So he starts just when there's like, I think it was one of the slave uprisings. So there was a little bit of sparks flying when he got here. And by the time he left, the Civil War had started. So you can read his letters as he travels through the North and the South as he writes these letters back to his brothers. And so he's explaining the situation. So you'll get a firsthand perspective from somebody on the ground that comes from the richest and most powerful family in the Western world at that time. And his conversations with the top elites in the Union and in the Confederacy. And basically at one point he's like, the situation here is like two giant locomotives under full heads of steam heading toward each other on the same track. And at the end, neither one is going to be able to like support itself. They'll be totally vulnerable. So he cited Solomon de Rothschild. His recommendation was for his family to fund the Confederacy. Now, in some of the other letters between other brothers, they say they are against slavery and they want to fund the Union and these sort of things. But then I'm having trouble finding the evidence where they actually funded Lincoln or did something like this. Cause, you know, you might know from watching The Money Masters, a very famous documentary on the history of American money, that Lincoln printed his own currency, greenbacks, during the war. And so there was Rothschild funding definitely to the American government pre-Civil War, and there was Rothschild government funding to the American government definitely after the Civil War. And I've been going through the actual events during the Civil War. I found two letters in an Anthony Sutton book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, where he refers to these two letters. And then I went and got the source material that he got, and I'm not really happy with the quality of the source material, so it's a little bit in question. I think I'm going to include it, but also just put a caveat with it and say, look, you would have to go to the Library of Congress or wherever this guy went to actually validate this. Because basically every declarative sentence in my book has a footnote and a primary reference source. And a lot of those reference sources come directly from the Rothschild archives in London and in France. So the other thing I found interesting about the Confederacy was On the day that Abraham Lincoln got assassinated, one of someone who knew Lincoln named Simon Wolfe met with John Wilkes Booth. Now, that's interesting because he knew Lincoln and he knew Booth. And when you dig into it, you find out he looked like Booth, so much so that when Lincoln was shot, this guy, Simon Wolfe, didn't leave his house until they caught Booth because he thought he would be mistaken for him. He also used to employ John Wilkes Booth in an acting company. So they were both actors, theatrical players, if you will, right? And even more interesting is the fact that Simon Wolfe wrote a book called Presidents I Knew, and he published it in 1918, and it covers like six presidents or five presidents that he knew personally, like in the Oval Office personally type stuff. And I found it interesting because right after the Civil War, Simon Wolfe spent some time abroad, and there were a couple different Confederates that I was researching at the time. What I discovered was after the Union won the war, a lot of the leaders in the Confederacy went into exile in Europe. Some of them went in England, like Judah Benjamin, right, who Solomon de Rothschild said was the smartest man in America. So when you've got the Rothschild family so closely mingling with the Confederacy, and their agent in America, a guy named August Belmont, who was in charge of the Democratic National Committee, and his son, who was also named August Belmont, who was also in charge of the Democratic National Committee. So for like 30 or 40 years, this family was in charge of the Democrats, but they were unionists. So Abraham Lincoln's strongest, you know, supporter, the Rothschild's agent in America, was still a Democrat, and his father-in-law was in charge of smuggling for the Confederacy to the Rothschilds. So I couldn't really, I'm still trying to discern that whole situation, but there's a lot of interesting history. And like I said, it's not really on anyone's map, which is why I'm writing the book.
Well, then it should be. You know, it's interesting that you bring that up because you and I had, you know, a lengthy conversation yesterday, and we were talking a little bit about Dave McGowan. But the last series Dave was doing before his untimely death, we were doing a series on Lincoln. And Lincoln's assassination and all the lies we've been told. And I remember at one point saying, man, if we had a time machine, I'd want to send Dave McGowan back to that time period so he could finish that series. But what was interesting was when they said it was John Wilkes Booth, when they put up the posters for John Wilkes Booth, it wasn't his picture. It was his brother's picture.
Well,
you know, there were so many irregularities and lies around that assassination. And when you think of without the kind of instant media, how easy it was for them to convince people of anything they wanted, you know, a month after the fact.
Well, allow me to digress for two more minutes on that topic then. Booth actually was, he worked, say, the Confederates didn't create their intelligence agency till right before the end of the war. But Booth had been making transactions in Canada under Judah Benjamin, who was in charge of the Confederate Secret Service. So there's the plausibility that Booth was a Confederate Secret Service guy working under the direction of these other guys who Solomon de Rothschild had visited. And I'm not making a causal claim there. I'm just saying there's only so many people involved in the story. And you got to look at how they interwork with each other. So there's these issues with Booth. Booth had a diary. Allegedly, it was found 8 days later on his body, right? These sort of things. But what's credible is when the Union Secret Service chief had picked it up, none of the pages were torn out. And then he gave it to Secretary Stanton. And then when it came to trial, a bunch of pages were torn out. So you've got these disputes between the Secretary of State and the guy who actually was doing the investigation for the Secret Service and wrote a book called The History of the Secret Service. His name is Lafayette Curry Baker. And so Baker ends up getting exiled. He writes this book about there's suspicious things going on with the Lincoln assassination. And then he is claimed to have died, but there's also evidence that he might have assumed another identity because as the guy who ran the Secret Service, he could counterfeit documents, assume other identities, take on disguises, do all these things, right? So even just looking into that little circumstance, Booth's diary is on display in Ford's Theater. You can go see it. You can go online and see pictures of it. You can see the missing pages. There's a lot of them. At the time of the hearing, there was only like 18 pages missing, and now there's 40 pages missing. So I'm just saying people can think they know the story because they got it in grade school, or you can engage in reality, leverage the assets and information that still exist and haven't been censored or destroyed yet, and do something. This is like life is not a spectator sport. We're supposed to be participating in this. And because we haven't been given all the information, I think that's a great place to start participating.
Absolutely. Rich, we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, let's get more, a little more into how to dissect the news, especially with all these recent shootings going on.
Solutions so after the break.
Solutions after the break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Oh, and Richard, by the way, if you want to use any of the audio that you and I have done through the years, you feel free to use it in your stuff.
Thank you.
Do you know what I mean? Your book, your documentary, you want to put it on your site, whatever you want to do. I mean, that's the least I can do for you.
Thank you.
All right, let's come back and do this. Hold on. Okay, welcome back to Tragedy and Hope. And there's always hope after the tragedies. And Lord knows we've been seeing plenty of tragedies in this country. But truthfully, Rich, I have to tell you, I've always said to myself, God, I don't know for how many decades, a country founded on genocide might just end the same way. And here we're looking at, I mean, you and I talked about a little bit yesterday. I can barely keep up with the shootings, people running into other people with trucks, so, you know, all these different murders. I thought I saw an active shooting this morning going on somewhere. How can people not jump to the conclusion that, oh, that didn't happen, nobody died, this is just lies because Trump told us it's all lies? How can people take a breather and actually do some research? What would be some of the places to start?
All right. Well, the first place is ask yourself, is learning about this topic in line with my priorities, my goals for today, short term, long term? Evaluate it. Because when you have the TV on and you got a news channel on, you're at the beck and call of what they're putting in front of you. And maybe you should be reading a book or outside doing something. So there's a whole bunch of other things. So avoid news in general. I learn according to my priorities, not theirs. So I take control over my schedule and I try not to let the whimsical nature of news and its emotional rhetoric play any part in my daily activities or productivity. So when I do want to learn something, and it's worth learning, I go through a method and I encapsulate everything that I'm learning about in a model, a model you can see online. It's like a network diagram, that I call the history blueprint. So as I learn stuff, I make this available to my audience and they can likewise learn and understand. I don't usually do current events first and foremost because the quality of information you're getting up front is crappy, for lack of a better term. You're not getting actual facts from actual sources. You're getting them watered down and passed through a bunch of different people and then approved and then not any attempt to make it into a cogent, coherent, non-contradictory narrative at all. All they do is give you a bunch of contradictions and that sends everybody off down that conspiracy trail. So first, figure out, is this something you need to really understand? And if so, is now the best time to get the quality information or maybe 6 months from now, right? Like, if you really care about any of these incidents, schedule something for 6 months and then start looking up so you can get the evidence, the police reports, the witness list, the evidence, you know, the court documents, anything that's going on. You could start to build out a coherent and cogent picture. And with regarding, like, you know, whether it's the recent shootings or any of these stories, really, you want to start with the 5 W's plus how. What is the identity of the time, the place, the person, you know, so on and so forth. So you're answering the question is, what is the identity of blank using the 5 W's plus how? And you're going to gather the general information that you could actually say is knowledge. This is knowledge about this topic. It might be limited when it first happens, but you can usually get, you know, at least a start on that. And then if you want to move forward, now you'd want to identify all the individual parts in the puzzle. So any media articles that might give you information will lead you to composing a picture. And this is what I use the history blueprint for. So I might learn about the guy who did the shooting. Where did he go to school? What was he up to? Who were his, like, what did he have a social media network? Was he making posts on Facebook, or they have this picture, or they have this video, and you can start to get a self-composed picture that is much more accurate than what they're ever going to give you on any of those news channels, no matter how hard they try, because their goal is not to help you learn in a cogent, coherent fashion. So as long as they don't have that as their goal, it's not going to be the product of you watching their show. So the same way I'm trying to write my book, which is, I don't know if there's a style to it, but I think most books are written to tell you a story. I'm not trying to convey a story. I'm trying to point out here is a chain of facts in a timeline that all relate to these various instances. And I'm giving you the actual quote instead of reading the quote and putting it in my own words. I'm like, here's the quote. Here's the source. Here's where you find it next. So I'm trying to write the book in the same way that people actually learn in a cogent and coherent way. So I don't know. I think it's lacking out there.
Right, well, it's not supposed to, you know, for the young people listening to the show who might not understand what the five W's are, that's who, what, where, why, and when. I'm assuming that's what you meant, right?
Yes. Is it not even taught anymore? Is it just like?
No, I don't think I can honestly tell you that if I said that to my grandchildren in their 20s, they wouldn't know what that meant.
Well, I think if that's the issue, then it's easily resolved, and it would explain a lot. Because without that, articles in newspapers. I mean, this is a mythical idea here. Articles in newspapers were once written using the five W's plus how. That's how they knew if they told you something that was valid and objective information that relates to reality. Did I give the five W's plus how? Oh, if not, why tell you about this event if I'm not going to tell you the place or the time or who it's, who's hosting it, right? As an example, like of an ad in the newspaper. Right. So not only the stories, but the ads also had to do these certain things. Once upon a time, there were rules that made them useful, but now there's no rules and it's not useful. And you see what happens. A bunch of people are wandering around, lost, not knowing what to do, getting depressed, totally unnecessary. But that is the default. That's what's going on. If you're not applying yourself using and leveraging these resources, if the internet is a liability, meaning all you're doing is buying stuff on there and it takes money out of your pocket, that's like level zero. Want to move up to level one? You have an internet connection. You could probably learn how to bring in some income. It might be $20 a month. It might be $200 a month. Depends on how much you apply yourself. Depends on how many skills you pick up to actually learn how to communicate value to people. But this is all doable, and it's not being done at the level where people are just like binging on Netflix as like their use of the internet, or writing on Facebook all day, or playing Facebook games, right? So I'm just trying to show people that are finding, they're like, there's a lot of obstacles in their path that they weren't told about. You're not the first one you're not alone, and you're not the first one. And there's a lot of great tools out here to help you navigate that. I think people in your audience already get that, but, it's important to keep reminding people that it's not just status quo. You can also grow.
That's why I made that point, because I do spend a lot of time around young people, not just my grandchildren. I spend time with younger than that, people in their teens, their late teens. And there are certain things that they just don't know. Even as if I would have said to the five W's to somebody, they would have looked at me like I was crazy. All right. This is why I take the time to work so closely with younger people, because I know they don't get that education. My granddaughter calls me for every kind of economic issue or problem, even if she has to file a complaint. They don't know any of those important things. And, she recently moved and she gave me the address. So I immediately went over to Zillow and looked at the place, looked at the house, saw when it was built, this, that, the other thing. And then when I called her and gave her the information, after she had moved in, she said, "How do you know all that?" I said, "Because it's out there." I said, "There's more to do with the internet than just Snapchat."
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So to her, "Grandma, you're a genius." No, I mean, there's a positive way to use the internet, especially to do research, and there's very little you can't learn if you're willing to put in the time.
Well, and if you want to put in the time, you can learn just about everything for free. If you want to shorten that time, you can pay for some courses that help you, like, save time. That's why they're valuable. I might spend $20 on a course that teaches me something so I can save $200 of time struggling and waiting and wandering and getting stuff wrong or buying the wrong thing later. So I would rather invest in myself up front because I know that I can internalize those skills and apply those skills in a practical direction so I can meet my various goals. And that's a skill set I think is essential. Just that discipline right there of having learned that you can learn something, apply it, that you're going to have the discipline to do it and carry through and it can be successful. Because then you can take that component and repeat it everywhere. And one of the most exciting study groups that I've done in the Tragedy and Hope community is the Entrepreneur Expertise Group. Because I just found out how many people who are my subscribers also have their own business or they want their kids to have an option not to go to college and be successful. Because the things you need to do in life to be successful are not taught in college. And I think the fact that kids are indenturing themselves and parents are indenturing their kids and parents are going into debt in order to provide an education that is obsolete like 50 years ago, right? These are not the things you need to do to be successful in today's world. But
well, you know, back in the day, they convinced us, you know, we're talking about the 50s and 60s. They convinced us that the only way to get a good job was to have a college education.
Well, the first thinking right there is that you need a job to be successful. That was a, that's a corporate pitch right there. What if you, what if you don't want to be a widget cranker for somebody else's dream your whole life? This is America. Are we really exploring our full potential if that's our highest aspiration? I'll go to Harvard so I can be a widget cranker for somebody who didn't go to school. Because look at the guys who are really successful. I'm not saying they're great character-wise, but as far as success, most of those guys didn't graduate from college. Did Zuckerberg finish? Did Bill Gates finish? Bezos probably finished. But, Richard Branson, did he finish? He dropped out of high school. So the examples of the people who actually write the checks aren't people that went to college. But if you want to be someone who cashes a check, maybe college is for you. You're going to have to write a check to get into college, a big check. And you're gambling whether or not your selection of a major is going to pay out in the form of a job. And so I don't see why people are gambling on all that stuff. I don't see why they're gambling on their kids' futures. But I think they lack better alternatives. So what I did was I designed a course that teaches a variety of skills that are involved in self-reliance in economic fashion, meaning that you'd have the skills to run your own business or to be a valuable manager or somebody higher in the structure if you're going to work in a corporate world. You want to get toward your full potential, and that involves leadership skills and time management, communication skills, marketing skills, sales skills, all the things that entrepreneurs, we do all these things ourselves. We don't really see it like all those jobs for you and I, Maria. It's just like in a day's work. But for everyone else, it's like if they had to create a web page and put their digital product, let's say somebody, makes an audiobook and they want to sell it, there's a whole bunch of things that need to be done in order to actually bring that to market. And we weren't taught these things in school. And what I'm discovering is there's a lot of subscribers that have kids that are getting ready to go to college and they're saying, hey, my kid's 17 years old and I don't want him to be a widget cranker for the rest of his life. Can you help him out? Yes, that's exactly what the curriculum for my subscribers is doing. So, part of freedom is economic freedom.
If people subscribe to tragedyandhope.com, and I'll put a link here for that, you get access to the Entrepreneur Expertise Study Group, which is great. You know, this country was always built by entrepreneurs, and I repeat that often because people have forgotten, which might be a reason why they want to cut Medicaid and kill Social Security, so old people who remember will die. But when I was a kid, and that wasn't that long ago, okay, even though some people think I'm as old as dirt, when I was a kid, so we're looking at, the 50s and 60s in America, Rich, everybody in my neighborhood, all their parents owned their own business. Very few people went to work for someone else. One guy owned a fruit store. One guy owned a fish store. One guy owned a butcher's. One guy was the plumber. One guy was the painter. It wasn't like today. It was, people had pride and they all owned their own businesses.
Well, when you see immigrants coming to this country, you see them not trying to go to college and get a degree and get a job. They start their own businesses. They have their families help them run the business. And if it wasn't for a large immigrant population in this country right now, running their own businesses, I think it would have died out in the last 10 years because it's not being taught anymore. And a lot of people who had family businesses couldn't convince the next generation that it was hip to do that. Right. I have a few friends that run family businesses and, they've stayed in that line of work. But a lot of other people just, it's a new era and that's an outdated technology, So this is where we could see commonality. Instead of seeing immigrants as people coming in, it's like those people are coming from a worse place than us. And I'm not saying that some sense of authority should steal from us to support them. I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying relate to other people as human beings first. Respect them as human beings first until they do something to not deserve your respect. And we could all get along so much better. But social media is not helping that. It's just drying all that stuff out to be kindled into a second American Civil War. And I've been saying for the past year or two that they've been building up to that. I see the Soros plan, the Gene Sharp strategies of how to start a revolution that have been used by the CIA and other countries coming home to roost. And, it's going to continue to happen until people fill in that blank of history. But once you understand that, the school system didn't give me what I need, then what do I need to do to fill in those blanks? They gave me a blind spot. I just found out about it. The logical thing is let's go fill that in and overfill it because it's a skill set that they must have taken away for a reason. And that reason is it takes away our autonomy.
And your independence. Let's not leave out your independence. The way it happened, I lived through it, so I can kind of tell you how it happened. Right around the mid to late 60s, I guess it was at the same time, the suburbs were developing and, the car and taking us away from, living cheaper. But all of a sudden, jobs were very seductive. It was something new. It was like insurance. There was very little insurance when I was a kid. You didn't need medical insurance. The doctor came to your house, you gave him $20, he left. You were in the hospital, you had a broken leg, the bill was $6,000, they set up a payment plan for you without interest. And at the same time, come work for us, we're going to give you a lot of money, we're going to give you free health insurance, you're going to get a raise every 3 months, promotions. It was very seductive. And, the American worker at that point, having a solid job, that could have lasted you the rest of your life with, constant raises. You knew you could depend on it.
And you get a gold watch when you retire.
Right. Now you get a kick in the ass if you're lucky. And it was interesting because, at the time I had teachers actually come to the house and beg my father to put me in college because I was one of the smartest kids in the school. My father was so against it, it didn't matter. He was always a gentleman with them. But he said, kids go to college to get stupid. And, I was upset, of course, with my father because I wanted to be like everybody else. But in retrospect, I'm so glad that he took that stand because the truth of the matter is people do get stupid in college because it's just more brainwashing. So, everything that I've ever learned, I'm self-taught. And I love learning, and I love studying. I have 4 books going at the same time, generally. When people say, how do you know all this? Well, because I do the homework. I do the homework so you don't have to. That's what I tell people. Because I know for a lot of people, they don't have the time, or they don't have the interest, or they don't have the basic learning skills. And that's not being taught in school either.
Well, let me help people with that, because that's a problem that a lot of people share, and we don't have time. Let's just end that myth right here. You got 1,440 minutes per day. You don't have 10 minutes to do X, Y, or Z? Come on. Let's be realistic. Maybe there's one of these other things need to go. A couple less chats on Facebook, you probably get that 10 minutes back. You have 86,400 seconds per day. Wasting time on this. All that stuff you're doing online, searching on your phone, that takes time. So if you're searching, is the result of that search going to be something that puts money in your pocket or makes you more of a slave to what's going on and what you don't know? These are choices that are made. Most people aren't thinking while they're making those choices. They're not conscious of how much time they're wasting every day. They're not conscious of what they're missing out, what the opportunity cost is of not being at their full potential or at least making strides every day toward living your full potential, right? So I would argue, I mean, I wouldn't argue this. I would observe that most people, going back to the beginning of this conversation, that you said are disenchanted with what's going on. They're discouraged. They're not at their full potential. If you were to ask them on a scale of 1 to 10, where you think you are in your school, your potential right now, they're not the people saying 8, 9. They're the people saying 3, 4, 5. Hey, would you like to move up a couple notches and see how you feel? Get some skills that are relevant. Might help take away some of the fear and uncertainty and unknowns of every day. Like, I created 3 one-page cheat sheets. One's, you know, these are things an autonomous, you know, self-responsible person thinks or does, right? The other one is how to solve problems, and the other one is how to learn anything. You would think somewhere in the 15,000 hours of schooling, they might have taught us something about that stuff, right? Those are skills you'd use every day in a multiplicity of ways. But, you know, if they don't exist, you got to create them.
Well, you and I have done shows in the past on the lack of critical thinking and how critical thinking is not taught either. So, you know, you have these young people that you know, they can't even make change for a dollar. You know, that new math was a mistake.
Was it a mistake? I mean, from whose perspective?
Well, for the rulers,
it worked. If it makes people more submissive and subservient, it works for them. We say, oh, that math was broken. It's no good. Well, it worked for somebody because, you know, they put spent money to put it there to do that.
But, you know, I look at some of these young kids and, you know, even something as simple as giving me the proper change. If you give them, say your bill is, you know, and this actually happened. The bill was like $16 and maybe 11 cents. So you give the kid $20 and 11 cents. She's giving me change, coins. I said, what are you making change for? I gave you the change. And then she kind of laughed at herself, because she wasn't like she was 12. She was probably about 18 or 19. And after I told her what the change should be, I looked at her and I said, how's that new math working out for you? I mean, I can't help myself.
Well,
you know?
It's not, not just the new math. It's also not understanding the reasoning behind why somebody would hand you the money with change as opposed to handing you a bill and expecting change. Like, there's two ways the money can be transacted. That person had never encountered the other way. And she's still
not. I usually mumble under my breath as I'm walking away. I fear for the future.
You should just get
a
t-shirt.
I can't help myself. I fear for the future. But that's why I'm saying, and I know most of my audience, you know, I'm sure knew what the 5 W's were. But today you can't assume that.
I'm sure
anymore.
They know somebody who doesn't know, though. And now they realize that it is something that I glossed over it because I was like, oh, well, everyone knows the 5 W's plus how. How else could you figure out how to hook up your phone to the internet without that stuff? But people don't know it explicitly. So, you know.
I know. So, you know, today I don't take anything for granted. You know, I actually will say, you know, do you understand what I just said? And if you don't, then at least ask questions. And getting back to you and how many minutes and how many seconds a day we have, a lot of times when I'm talking to students or clients or whatnot, they, you know, they're so busy working and doing this and that, but they're very unhappy. And I tell them, do you at least give yourself 1 hour a day to do whatever you want to do? And they look at me like, what? Like, it's a foreign concept. I said, if you don't spend at least 1 hour a day doing what you want to do, whether it's fun, relaxation, reading, studying, whatever, what was the point in being alive that day?
Right.
Well, so, you know,
it's a mentality of implicit slavery because they don't understand what they're missing out on. It's like, from an entrepreneur perspective, I make every hour of the day my day. Like that's part of living your life is it's like, you know, you are guiding your own life. You are writing your own script. You're not living out a script that's written for you by somebody else. That's the difference between the mentality of being a subservient cog in a big machine or being an autonomous individual who knows how to apply their cognitive liberty to be able to sustain themselves, to survive and thrive in the world, you know, working voluntarily with others and not obligatorily to some corporation that might take away your job at any reason, right? At any time without any explanation and take away your career and your means. Like that's like living with the sword of Damocles hanging over your head every day. And it might be very effective from a managerial side to get these people to do what you want. But from a human living the living life side, it kind of sucks. And that's why I think that since we're one of the few places on the planet that actually allows people to run their own businesses, you couldn't do this in Soviet Russia, run your own business. So, you know, take a chance, build your skills, see what's out there for you, make some choices, fail often, fail early, and you'll have success sooner.
Right. Well, Rich, thank you so much for joining me today, and we'll actually have to do this more often. So I'll talk with you soon.
Thank you so much, Maria. Thank you to you listening.